Hello, and welcome back to episode 4 of the Queer Kahani Podcast, a quirky and curious podcast of bite-sized queer stories told in an interactive interview format. I'm your host, Sumu Tasib, and in this fourth episode, we'll be talking with Brianna Mendoza, author, therapist, and more importantly, a sex therapist, about her fabulous book, Clitoris Chronicles. As always, more information about this episode and the podcast is at our website, queerkahani.com, where you can find all the links we mention in the episode, as well as information on how to submit your own story. With that, let's start the show. Welcome, Brianna. We're so happy to have you here.
I'm so happy to be here.
It's so wonderful. So Brianna and I actually met at SEAF. Mm-hmm. And the Seattle Erotic Arts Festival, the mm-hmm. topic of episode 3. And we were both authors there. And I picked up Brianna's book and she picked up my book. And we had a great conversation there. And we've been talking since that time in February about doing this episode. Mm-hmm. So Brianna, let's start with finding out a bit more about you. So you're a therapist and a sex therapist. Could you talk about how those roles are different and what your path to that was?
Yeah. Well, I feel like, I mean, they are the same, right? They're both therapy, but sex therapy is more focused on sexuality, gender, bodies, experiences within relational contexts, things like that, and whereas therapies can be more general. But honestly, with sex therapy, you do so much overlap work, like depression, anxiety really affects sex, you know, or our attachment patterns we have from childhood really affects Absolutely. Relationships. So mm-hmm. it all kind of melds together. But essentially, sex therapy is a place for people to explore discomforts or having your own sex, maybe misconceptions they have, because we grow up in a world where we are taught all these things and then we're afraid to explore what actually feels true for us. And so we just kind of lean into that and think, oh, this is just, even if we're having problems, we're like, oh, well, this is just how it is, right? These stereotypes must be true because it's too hard to explore more. I don't think that has to be how it is. So that's where I come in and just starting to help people explore and actually talk about their needs and communication and starting to improve their life and relationships around sex and their own bodies.
That's awesome. It makes me think of two questions, actually. So for our listeners who might be thinking about a potential career in something like that, like how does one go from a traditional therapy program to mm-hmm. becoming a sex therapist?
Well, there is a program called ASECT that is not at all universities, but they're at select places across the country, and it helps you kind of deepen your therapy knowledge specifically around sex. And I really recommend, even if people aren't going to go into specifically want to do the sex therapy route, a lot of traditional therapy programs maybe have a human sexuality class, but that's the extent of their training in sex. Mm. And sex is a really huge topic of shame. Yeah. It can be a place that people just won't bring up in therapy, even if they're having issues. Yeah. And so I'm always fascinated to see, you know, like even before I was in this program or before I did this program, people wouldn't tell me things. And later on, I might bring up something about sex or just ask them specifically. And then this whole flood of information comes out that they've just never thought they could tell me. And so one of the first like principles of sex therapy is permission. And so a lot of times it's just giving permission to talk about the stuff that we in traditional conversations keep quiet.
Oh, that brings me right to my next question, which is mm-hmm. that like if, you know, some of our audience members are interested in finding someone who is a qualified and trained sex therapist, how would they go about doing that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So ASECT actually has a whole website online, and you can look up people who've gone through the program and have gone through tons of training. You have to go be supervised for a number of years and have seen so many different issues around sexuality. And they can find a licensed therapist who is ASECT qualified. They can also just look on Psychology Today and specifically put in sexuality as a tag. I think those are the two main ones, or just, you know, any kind of therapy finding website. There's a ton of different ones online that you can look into, and just tagging sexuality. And that can be a way that you can find access to that stuff. Also, I find a lot of queer therapists tend to be more versed in sexuality related issues. So finding a queer specific therapist can also help you kind of lean into that a little bit more.
That actually reminds me that Psychology Today and using their tag system was how I found my therapist. Right. So double recommendation on that as being a great way to find someone.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the kinds of clients and organizations you work with as a sex therapist.
Yeah. So I work with, I specifically do a lot of work with queer and trans folks. I started actually my work in youth work. So I have a lot of young people I also see who are now young adults. And then a lot of folks who are dealing with trauma, whether that's trauma related to family of origin or bad relationships or, accidents, like kind of across the board. So I think those are kind of my client population mostly. And people come to me to talk about everything from pain with sex to feeling like they can't really be in their bodies, to having issues with orgasm, to feeling like they can't ask someone out, like having maybe some social anxiety or struggling with depression and having that affect their sex drive. Or I do a lot of work on gender identity. So thinking about, you know, what their gender is, how to communicate that to other people in their lives that are important to them. Couples work around that too. So that's kind of the main folks that I see. And then as far as organizations I work with, I do a lot of work with Ingersoll Gender Center. There's a big consult group online that I am a part of. So that's where I find a lot of information specifically for trans and queer folks. Gallup is another great organization that does letters for trans folks who are looking for surgery letters.
Oh, yeah.
I also am part of Shelterwood, which is a therapy group in Seattle, and they don't do as much sex therapy. They do more general therapy, but are a great place for finding therapy resources. And there's so many different places. I also am part of like a sex therapy consult group through Antioch. That's where I went through my program. Mm. And let's see. And then I also work with a friend who does sex education work, and her organization's called Papaya Project. She's still working on our website, but we've been doing like workshops on how to tell your sexual story, how to talk to if you're a parent, how to talk to your kids about sex. And we've been doing sex trivia at Optimism, which has been super, super fun, because it's like getting people to learn about sex, but they don't realize it, and they're having a drink and having a great time. And then they're like, wow, you know, the most amount of orgasms is like in the hundreds. That's incredible. I could do that, right? So those are some things I've been working on.
That's awesome. And for our listeners, we'll have links to all of those things in the episode information for episode 4. So in addition to your work as a sex therapist, you're now also an author of this fantastic book. And I really wish the audience could see the book. It's just such a beautiful piece of work and so delightful in so many ways. And we'll talk about the art and the design and all those things as we go on in the podcast. And you can find the links in the episode. But I guess at a high level, I would say it's almost like a children's book for adults, you know, and it has a beautifully approachable quality to it and dealing with some really complex adult issues, despite being in this very non-threatening kind of format.
Yeah. Well, first, thank you. I know I love my book. It's amazing. Me and Danny worked really hard on it. Actually, it's been kind of a passion project for a ton of people in my life, just because, you know, I talk about it a lot and I get people's feedback a lot and I've had everybody review it. So I feel like everyone I know at some point has talked about or, you know, read or weighed in on Clitoris Chronicles.
Could you tell us, like, you know, you're working as a sex therapist, you're working with all of these youth and other kinds of audiences, you know, and you're working with these various kinds of projects and centers. And at some point you decided, I need to write a book. Like, what was that journey like? What led you to create a book and decide that was a important part for you?
Well, it isn't. I actually thought of the concept of Clitoris Chronicles when I was 18.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, just because of the name itself. We were just doing this earlier of like, is it clitoris or clitoris or clitoris or, you know, how do you say it? No one had ever really said it to me as, you know, all the way up until I was 18. I feel like maybe someone had said it at some point. But anyway, so I would always call it a clitoris to my best friend, and she'd be like, Brianna, you've got to stop saying it like that. It sounds like you're talking about a dinosaur. And I couldn't get it. I just like kept doing it. And so one day we both were joking around about it, and we're like, oh yeah, we should, you know, we should write something about this. It could be like, you know, the clitoris, the dinosaur, and she could live in the land of Gina, and, you know, where there could be babbling brooks, and I don't know, all this stuff. So that's where it started a long time ago. And then the thought of it really helped bring like life and fun to my, that formation of sexuality at that time. Because before then I felt kind of ashamed. I didn't know how to say it, and I didn't know how to feel about it. And I was like too afraid to really talk to people about it, except for my best friend. And so I think later on when I became more comfortable with it, it just like came into my mind. I was working with so many young people who had a really hard time talking about it. And so I was like, I feel like there should be something in the world that's playful and fun and helps people feel more able to have these kind of conversations and say the word clit without it being, you know, intimidating or having it be something fun. Yeah. And so I think I just impulsively one day was like, I should just do it. What if I just did a whole book on it and not just like, you know, made this fun little story?
Yeah.
What if the story could be something more? And started pulling people in, and it became this huge queer collaboration. And then Clitoris Chronicles was born.
And could you talk a little bit, for, you know, we have a lot of people who are authors or authors to be in our audience. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about what the publishing process was like and how you approached that?
Yeah, I had no idea how to publish a book. I never have written anything. I don't know if I will write anything after this, because it wasn't like it was a terrible process. It just took a long time, especially with the illustrations. Mm. But I didn't know how to find someone, so I just started asking. Mm. That was my first step into it. It's like, how do you publish something? What does it look like? So I started asking people I knew who had written books. I started reaching out to authors I knew and asking how they'd gotten published. And I started getting a lot of feedback of like, okay, so you could go the Amazon route, right? Which is, you know, hands off, no publisher, because publishers are a nightmare and you make zero money and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, I don't really care about making money. I just want people to, you know, be able to talk about this. I want this to be an education tool. And so I was like, okay, well, maybe I don't want to go through a traditional publisher, but I also don't want to spend all my time packaging books and, you know, I don't know. And I hate Amazon because they're taking over the world. And I, especially when I was doing this, I was like in a really, I hate Amazon place in my life. And so I was like, okay, well, I got to find someone who can help me do that part, but isn't a traditional publisher. And so I found Meg, and Meg started Papichu Press, which is a press for women and non-binary folks, queer and trans folks, I think, largely. Mm-hmm. And because Meg worked at publishers and figured out it's not accessible for most folks.
Mm, yeah.
And so I actually found out about her through another friend who knew her from a coffee shop that they – I think Meg would come in and get coffee from my friend or something, and was like, oh, I actually know someone. And so then I reached out to Meg, and we started a conversation, and this was the kind of work she wanted to be doing. Like, a lot of the stuff on Papichu's site is poetry. It's sex education. It's education about stories. And so and we just hit it off, and then that's kind of where it started. And then I kind of got the rest rolling from there. But yeah.
That's awesome. So I found the book really delightful and informative. I mean, you know, even as an adult, like, I feel like there's a lot there, I think, for pretty much anyone reading it. But I'm really curious who you see as your primary audience, both in terms of like age group, like stage of life, stage of relationship, maturity. Like, who are you? Who do you think this book is most for?
Yeah, I've thought about this a lot. And I think this is why I'm terrible at marketing things, is because I'm like, well, couldn't everybody benefit from it?
I think they could.
But I think my main audience was kind of middle school, high school, young adult, and honestly adult. Because I think about like my mom or my grandma, you know, and how like neither of them told me what a clitoris was. And I feel like actually my mom's pretty sex positive, but still there's like, I think a lot of, you know, things that she didn't know or get access to. And so I really feel like people of any age could benefit from it, and it has something in it for everybody. And so like for my mom specifically, she shared it with a lot of her friends, and they've had like the best time, you know, talking about this book.
So,
and
good.
It's brought up all these like fun sexual stories that they may not have shared otherwise.
Yeah.
And I've had friends like read through it with a partner who's, you know, like in their 30s and have said, wow, we like talked about things I never imagined we'd talk about, you know, and things I liked, things like they liked, and it created this conversation. And so I think what we've kind of tried to target at is like people who are assigned female at birth. Mm-hmm. But then I've also heard really great feedback from people who are assigned male at birth, like my, like, still like cis male friends who have been like, oh, you know, I wouldn't have thought about that. And just like asking a lot of questions and kind of thinking more about consent and also their own body and their consent in their own body, which has been really cool. And then also like trans and non-binary friends who are like, it was cool to see me in the book, you know? And like, I feel like queer and trans people have to have some more of these conversations. So it's not, it hasn't been as revolutionary for a lot of my queer and trans friends. It honestly has landed more like my straight friends have feel like that's where it's been more memorable for some reason. But, yeah. So I think the audience is wider than I know, and I have a hard time narrowing it down.
No, I think that's great. I mean, like, honestly, like, I feel like I love how the book was just subtly educational, even in its most, you know, charming aspect. Like, you know, this character of clitoris is anatomically, you know, in the shape of the organ, and like, and that in itself is teaching people, like, just from the way the character is created, I think is really, it's just wonderful.
That's been one of my primary conversations I've had with people of like, oh, this is an anatomical like clitoris. Right. Yeah. And people are like, oh, what do you mean? And I'm like, this is what a clitoris looks like.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
You know, cause it's like an iceberg. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's under the surface.
Yep.
And they're like, oh, what do you mean? And so then I show them a picture and they're like, oh, wow, I didn't know. Or they pretend like they did know, but then are really looking at the picture. But I feel like a lot of people don't know what it looks like.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I knew that.
Yeah. And then I'm like, actually, it's really similar in structure to a penis and functions really similarly.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like clits get aroused. They get erections. They get hard. They have all those things, too. And so, you know, it's a helpful tool to explain that with people. So it's been that's actually a great point to bring up, you know.
So I'm really curious about, like, you know, how do you see bringing this book, you know, into your practice as a therapist as well? Like, how can those two parts of your world help each other?
Yeah, I think, honestly, I feel like I've brought it less into my own therapy sessions, maybe because of my own self-consciousness of promoting my work, you know, because you're supposed to have this really separation between, you know, yourself as a person, not self as a person, but you know, your work and then therapy. But I've really recommended it and put it out to the sex therapy community, and it's been used a lot. So I probably need to use it more in my own practice. It's just, I got to get past that. Like, you don't have to buy it. I'll give you with this book and you can, you know, look through it and see if it's useful to you. But I've had a lot of people, colleagues actually tell me that it's been really useful for their clients, especially when they're struggling with orgasm, embodiment, communication with their partners, difficulty coming back to their bodies after like using depression medication, or communicating their likes and dislikes, or trying out the dance moves and being like, I've just never tried anything different, so it was fun to just try something. So I think I want to try to use it more in that way in my own practice. I think I'm still figuring out that tricky period of like, I don't want you to have to buy this thing, but I think it could be useful for you. So essentially how I do that is I put a lot of stuff on my website and I recommend people there. And they can choose if they want to look into it, they can buy it. And I also have a ton of resources on there of different Instagrammers and things so that people can continue to find out more information about sexuality and bodies and queerness and all of that stuff.
That's awesome. And we'll have a link to your website, of course, as part of this episode. So let's talk about Clitty, your main character. I love the way that she's represented as a dinosaur-like creature. Like, how did you come to embody her the way that you did?
Well, I wanted her to look like an anatomical clit, so that was really important. And actually, before I even started the story, I didn't know what an anatomical clit looked like. And so I looked it up as part of creating her character and was like, oh my gosh, it looks like a little pterodactyl. You know, it's got the little head and the little wings and, you know, the bulbs look like little feet. And so then I was like, it is a dinosaur. And it's also super old, you know, as old as humanity. So it's kind of is a dinosaur. So anyway, I think I wanted her to look like an anatomical clit because there's so much misconception about how big, like vast the clit is. And so I wanted people to see its full form so that they could start to ask more questions about how its function is. So that's how that came to be. And then we added little nice spikes so that it created the dinosaur element. And yeah, so I think that's how the form came to be.
Yeah, I was wondering, you know, like, because there is that, it felt like there was a subtle homage to, like, the lizard brain mm-hmm. aspect of kind of, like, you know, there is this very deep, you know, very old part of us that is there. And then, so having her be a dinosaur felt like it was a really great manifestation of that.
Yeah, definitely.
So one of the things that that really struck me about the book was, even though there's like a lightness to the story, there's a lot of dark shadows that we kind of see her encounter, especially with some of the characters. And she goes through some pretty challenging situations. I mean, like, you describe them in a lighthearted way, but there's clearly some darkness there too. And I'd just love to hear more about your thoughts about how you balance that, you know, the kind of lightness and darkness and bringing up some difficult situations, but still, you know, kind of keeping it approachable.
Yeah. I mean, I think humor is how we get through so much of life's darkness. And I think sex is this really murky territory where all of us have some kind of trauma around sex in our bodies. It may not have anything to do with us. It may just be messages we've received from other people. It may have been bad experiences. It may just come from the fact that we have such bad education that our primary experiences usually are really muddled. You know, they tend to be a little murky as far as consent, unless we had, you know, good people in our lives who gave us that information. A lot of people, you know, look back at those experiences not necessarily in positive ways. And so I actually started her journey with kind of a muddled consent, bad communication, you know, experience, which is like, this should be fun, right?
Chad,
I know, which I could tell you more about Chad and the choosing of that name later. But yeah, I think it was, you know, this thing that maybe a lot of people have gone through where they didn't really know if they're ready for something and they were like signing up for it because it sounded like it could be good. And then they're there and they're like, can I stop this thing? Is this okay? Do I like it? I don't know. I don't know what I like yet. And so I think but it's also, I put in this funny stuff so it can keep moving us, right? Because I think a lot of our sexual experiences or our sexual understanding comes from experience, right? It's a process. It's a process of learning through doing. And unfortunately, in that doing, sometimes we get hurt. And then we have to lean on our friends or community ourselves to bounce back from that so that we can keep coming back to the table and learn more.
Yeah.
And most of my own experiences, it's been that way too. You know, like, Clitty is in a lot of ways me, you know, and just my own story of figuring out my own sexuality and my own pleasure, my own body, and also a compilation of a lot of other people's stories who've told me, you know, about these moments of hurt or confusion or just brokenness that I think a lot of us bring to the table when it comes to sex. And like, how do we start to create a sense of normalcy and lightness and play and so that we can create some more safety in having communication and consent and talking about this stuff. So that's why it's a journey, and that's why it's got, you know, these like stereotypes and these tropes and stuff like built in there, because of course we want those things to change, but that doesn't mean there can be some element of truth in some of those things, because a lot of us go through that in some way. And so I built those into the book too, to help people maybe connect with pieces of a metaphor, pieces of a trope, or pieces of like a way that there was lightness around something. So that's how I balanced like the light and the dark.
Yeah, and I really appreciated how, you know, there would be characters like Chad, who I love, that's represented just as a mustache. Sort of perfect. but you know, who are very you know, kind of explicitly problematic, you know, like even in a physical dimension, you could see those things. But then other characters that were problematic in a more subtle way, like because mm-hmm. they were just so confident that their way was the right way.
Right.
You know, and I think that helped, you know, kind of draw together a wide spectrum of you know, of experiences that can feel unfulfilling. Mm-hmm. And it's not just all one pattern.
Yeah. And especially that idea too of maybe this thing worked for that one character. And so they're trying to share this knowledge that exactly. works for them.
Yeah.
And when we just go with someone else's knowledge of what works for our bodies, it may not work for us. And then that becomes the problem too. And then that's where people get the sense of like, I'm broken, or there's something not right, or I'm not normal.
Yeah.
When really all of us are just going to need something different, and we may learn something from someone, but it may not be the whole that we need for ourselves.
So I'm glad you brought up the point earlier that Clitty was in some sense you, because the next question I was going to ask you was about the fact that Clitty is also an author. Like we see her at the beginning, like thinking about writing a book, and by the end she's doing a book signing. And for me, that really was like, okay, if I had doubts about there being an autobiographical tie, like it kind of clinched it for me. It's kind of like, oh, there's a real connection here. And I feel like it gave the story, you know, both a more autobiographical feel, but also a more vulnerable feel, because you were putting yourself in it. And like, how did you navigate that decision of kind of, you know, putting yourself in that, you know, in that vulnerable place?
Yeah. Well, we got to talk about this a little bit, because, you know, in your book, you went to putting your own story out there in more of a literal way. Like, it is your story. It is the exact things that happened. You change names, all that stuff. But it's things you went through. And I think for me, I went back and forth on whether or not I wanted to do something like that, and whether or not I wanted to create it more like open and through metaphor, so that it may relate to people in a different way. And I think part of that decision was because I'm a therapist, and part of our training is like, don't put out too much of yourself, right? Because you're supposed to be this thing people are bouncing off of.
Yep.
I've now come to like start to unlearn that more. And I think that therapy actually should be a place that, as a therapist, people are vibing off of you, because there's something about you that may be connecting for them.
Yeah.
And I think there should be transparency about who we are and what our values are, so that people can find that person who does feel like an emotional match with them. And I also think that therapists shouldn't have to hide those pieces themselves when we're trying to tell people to not hide and feel shame and silence. And so I've been trying to figure out a balance of putting out my own story more, just like who I am. And without, cause I'm not asking for people to take care of me in that. Like I have done the work to take care of myself.
Yeah.
And so I just did actually another podcast with Fruit Bowl, where I put out my story there. It's like my whole like journey of queerness and sexuality.
Yeah.
And that was a scary decision to be like, okay, I'm going to put this into the world and people are going to know this stuff about me. I have no problem talking individually one-on-one with people, cause I do have processed that stuff. But it is scary when you put it into a context of like a business and a book and all these things.
Yeah.
And I so admire people who do that work, and I'm trying to be more authentic in that way. But it is scary. And I really admire you for putting your story out there so vulnerably like that.
Thank you.
And this was a different way that I was able to do it at that time. And who knows, in the future I may do that differently, but this felt, I think the other part of it, of why I did it a little differently, is I wanted the story to be really playful, and I wanted it to have this kind of childlike, campy feel to it. And I think that's why the illustrations and the way that the story is told is, you know, very short. I wanted it to be short and something that people could consume quickly, but have maybe big takeaways from. And so a big autobiography might not have achieved that. Like, people are in the stage of like TikTok, where it's like too long, didn't read. And I wanted it to be something that people could consume in a short way that might still have an impact. And so that's how I did it.
That makes sense. So that is a great segue into my next set of questions, which is about the artwork. So the illustrations by Danny Tayara are just so charming and have so much personality. But before we get into the art itself, could you tell us a little bit about Danny and how the two of you started working together?
Yeah. Danny is a mixed race queer storyteller, illustrator, and filmmaker. They're actually from Washington, as am I. So Danny actually did a bunch of work for Real Queer Youth, which is a program in Seattle that trains young people, queer young people, on how to do films. And Danny and I originally met through Camp Ten Trees, which is an amazing camp for queer and trans youth, or youth from queer and trans families. So that's where we first met. And then from there, I actually was a therapist for Real Queer Youth. and just like was kind of in the background if people needed anything. And I'd reach out on Facebook asking for, you know, does anyone do illustration? Is anyone interested in doing this? Does anyone know illustrators? And Danny reached back and was like, yeah, like I actually want to get into illustration. I haven't done it yet. I'm a filmmaker, all this stuff. And so then we went from there. So it was this huge learning process for both of us because it was the first time I was being like, you know, writing in this way. And it was the first time that Danny was illustrating.
Oh, wow.
And so we just, it took us forever. We worked on this project for, I think I reached out to Megan like 2017.
Oh, wow.
And we published it last year.
Oh, wow.
And so I think me and Danny started illustrating in 2018. So it was like 3 years of illustrating. Because we'd go back and forth on each drawing, you know, figuring it out. And they hung in there with me through this whole process. And we both learned a lot because it was both of our first times really creating something like this.
That's really awesome. And I mean, I think it's, you know, it's very, I would never have known this was their first illustration project. It's really very wonderfully done. And the characters are so expressive. I'm really curious about, you talked about a bit about the visual concept about being anatomically correct. But were there, you know, other visual representations or styles that you considered along the way? Like you ended up with a particular form. Was there, you know, like, you know, other kinds of rendering or like, you know, black and white or like other kinds of things that you thought about?
Yeah. I mean, we did so many different renditions of all the characters because Danny would draw them and we'd kind of hash through, you know, how we wanted the eyes to look or, you know, how we wanted, what colors to use. And we actually did a whole rebrand on the color right before we published it because we had time during the pandemic, which ended up being kind of a nightmare because then we got, like, I think I got too stuck in perfectionism of like, okay, well, how do we make it not look like it's for kids and looks like for adults? And so we like changed like the line width and the colors and all this stuff. So it was a process of kind of figuring out how do we cater it to an older audience, but still make it like campy and playful and, you know, kind of draw people in. So, and each of the Clitty, I feel like remained pretty consistent.
Okay.
Through our renditions, I feel like a lot of the characters, like Marty, changed a lot through our rendition. Because we actually originally were going to have Marty as a sex doll. But then we changed it because we were like, oh, that might, like, it got into all these different things around gender that we got. We're like, oh, that might come off the wrong way. And so anyway, we changed it into, and we also wanted there to be another Clit in the book. And so Marty ended up being another Clit. So
yeah, I love the character of Marty, of course. Mm-hmm. And you know, I love the fact that each character is so unique, but I mean, like, but you can also see like elements of queerness, like, you know, and like, you know, from their, it'll be from their costumes and their hair, and sometimes even their accessories. It'll highlight, you know, things about their queerness, about their personality, about problematic aspects of the character. I thought that was really brilliant how subtly that's woven into each character.
Yeah, thank you. I think Danny really should take the credit for a lot of that because they really, with like the color and stuff, brought out a lot of that stuff. Like one of my favorite characters is Flangina, and that was a lot of Danny. You know, Danny put on, I think it was Danny's idea to do the purple robe and have it be see-through, and it was
purse.
It's just like the phone cord. Like, there's just so many good different elements of Flangina that are, I think that, yeah, she's one of my favorite characters for sure.
Yeah, I love Flangina as well.
Yeah, so, but yeah, every character went through a lot of evolution, or Lang was originally a different name and gender, and then we changed Lang, and so now they're to be a non-binary person, and then we like tried to make them like a little more queer, so we gave them a little hat, and you know, and then they've got like the tongue on the tongue thing. It's just, there's a lot of fun ways that each character is like comes to life, I think.
Our mostly queer audience knows that wearing a hat always makes you more queer.
Yes, especially if it's a little beanie, you know. So
no, it's really wonderful to see the diversity of characters, and I think the range of representation in terms of gender, orientation, race, seeing all of that come through, and the, you know, the names, the kind of names that they have, and even the ways that they behave and, you know, and how they interact with each other, I think is really wonderful. And I think that helps, like, I imagine it helps the book reach more people because it adds to the universality of the experience.
Yeah, I hope so. I think that was one of the biggest things we kept coming back to is like, how can we help this land and also represent more people? I think a lot of sex education material is really white and yes. really cis yes. and hetero-leaning. And mm-hmm. so we wanted to put a lot of other characters that could hold a lot more of that experience. And as a cis, white, queer, female person, I was like, well, the main character is more of my story. And so I was like, I don't want to claim a different story than is mine. And so sure. that's where I was writing from. So I don't know if we're going to do another book because it was so much work, but yeah. we wanted to go down one of the other narratives next, you know, like do something with Flangina or with Marty, you know, like, mm. or with Lang, you know, all of them have their own kind of stories. And I really think there needs to be more like non-binary and like, you know, like POC, BIPOC, sex education material out there. And especially just even like anatomically, you yeah. know, most art, or most like textbooks are with white, cis anatomy.
Yeah.
And that yeah. is really, and it also like perfected, right? Like mm-hmm. that's so not representative of what people actually look like and the majority of people. So that needs to be a thing. So we tried to incorporate that into the book as best as we can. But it's not good enough, I think.
So I do have to ask a question about Ling's tongue.
Yeah.
Tell me about Ling's tongue. Like, I was so curious when I was reading it. Like, the character of Ling has a tongue, like, just sticking out the whole time that you see this character. And I was like, this is really interesting. I have to ask.
Yeah. Actually, Lang was not Danny or I's creation. It was one of my friend Aaron's creation. And she makes a lot of, like, hilarious, like, sexy art stuff. Like, okay. she did a whole art thing that was called Lisa Stank, because Lisa Frank was like a big sticker thing that's like very colorful. Yeah. And it was like butt plugs and gosh, I don't even remember what else was in there, but like, like a cat, like a leg with hair and just all these different things. So a lot of her art is very like pushing the edges of things. And so anyway, she came up with the tongue sticking out. It's like, I don't know, some kind of
Ling is a tongue.
Ling is a tongue.
With a tongue sticking out.
Yes.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yes, exactly.
I love it.
So Ling is, lengua is in Spanish is tongue.
Okay.
And so Ling's name actually came out of that. And Ling also sounds like a queer name. And so that's how Ling got their name.
Oh, that's good.
And then Ling is also a chef at a vegetarian restaurant. Yep. So there's that added, you know,
vegetarian
fun punness to it as well. So that's the story of Ling.
I love the way that you use these puns in double entendre. Is there kind of an intentional layering of layers for different kinds of readers being able to understand what's going on with those puns?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that maybe if they land, they land, but the story and the feeling there is still consistent. So I think it still has like a fun, playful element, even if the puns aren't there. And I think that the puns make it really fun for certain people maybe who are able to see that. So I think that also might help with like it working as a children's book, you know, because the kids aren't going to pick up on the puns, but as they get older, they might start picking up on those things. And it's fun to feel like you're in on it, you know? And just, I love puns. And I just think like sexual innuendos are so interesting, the way that we work them in messed up ways sometimes in society and fun ways. But I had a lot of fun. You should see my Google search from writing this book and creating the characters. I feel like it's really stretches through all the sexual topics because I was just, you know, always constantly thinking of like new puns and new things that could be, you know, that go with clit or anything, honestly. So, but I think it was really fun to write in that way.
Okay, I don't think I'll ever forget the first scene where poor Clit is being like pounded by dodgeballs.
With those creative juices flowing.
I was like, oh, poor Clitty. That does not sound good.
Yeah.
So this is wonderful, and this leads me right into my next set of questions, which is really about your use of language. And I think you had such a wonderful balance of dealing with very adult and sometimes even taboo topics, but using really accessible language with a lot of humor and lightness, which adds to the picture book quality, the children's book quality for adults. Could you talk about the way that you chose, like, the writing style that you use to discuss things in this book?
Yeah, I think so much sex education out there is trying to be really informative, right? So they use really like medical terms, yeah, and
clinical
and anatomical, yeah, pictures, mm-hmm, that are very, you know, to the point.
Yeah.
And I think those can be kind of intimidating for people, yeah, and also feel kind of boring. Yeah. And so a lot of the reason why we chose the language we did is because, well, I chose the language I did is that I wanted people to feel like it was a fun experience and that they were learning something but didn't realize they were learning it. Kind of like the sex trivia that I'm doing as well. It's, yeah, like this kind of incognito learning where people are reading this thing, having a good time. Mm-hmm. And the shame and fear around sexuality doesn't come into it as much because I think people don't consume sex education material as often because of avoidance that comes with fear. Because, yeah, fear tends to lead us to move away from things. And if people have had bad experiences with sex or have been told it's a shameful topic, they don't want to learn about it or they feel scared to. And so I wanted to make it something that felt accessible and fun and silly and light and almost this thing that we never got. Right? Like a lot of us never got a positive experience with sex education. It was embarrassing. It was scary. It was like gross. And I wanted this to be light and fun and cute and something that is easy to consume so that people could overcome some of those barriers that get in our way.
Yeah. And I think you definitely achieved that. When I've had friends like pick up your book at my place, like their first reaction has been like, oh, this is so fun. And this is so, you know, like, and they just dive right in. And I think it really captivates people in that way.
Oh, I love hearing that.
The other thing is that I'm someone who loves puns. And I just adored the way that you brought all these sexy double entendres to Clytie's adventures. And I'm going to ask you to actually read a bit here from when she goes with Phalangina, our favorite character, to the G-spot, the hottest club in Volvoland.
So Clytie had been focusing so intently on doing the moves perfectly that she completely forgot why she was there in the first place. Phalangina kept telling her to go with the rhythm. She was too worried about how she looked and if she was doing things right to let any hint of a climax enter her mind. Although she was having fun, there was still something missing that she couldn't quite put her finger on.
And I just think that so perfectly describes both the awkwardness of dancing at a club and also of like overly technical sexual play when someone's so focused on a technique that it doesn't work.
Exactly, yeah. Or somebody's so consumed by their own appearance that they can't actually be present in their body. So both of those things. And there's this idea of being good at sex.
Yeah.
And it's like, how the fuck is anybody good at sex? Like none of, yeah, us had good education. Like maybe you watch porn, you think you're good at sex and watching porn. That's not great. That's not really where you should be getting that education. Yeah. Like a lot of where we learn is from experience through communication, is through being able to ask people what feels good to them. And so I wanted to represent that of just, you know, it is hard to not get in your head in sex. Yeah. It's hard not to feel caught up in being perfect or doing things right or, you know, being good at something. And, you know, asking things doesn't mean you're bad at it. It means you're actually aware, practicing consent, going toward what feels good to someone else. And then telling people what feels good to you is also not a bad thing. That gives people a lot of clarity and makes them less anxious. And so then they can share the same things back with you. So I wanted to represent that because I definitely have had my own experience of that. And I just know so many people who've had a hard time being present in sex because of all of the rest of the things that are hang-ups.
And I think it's a really powerful and apt analogy because I think like dancing at a club and having sex are both things which I think we grow up seeing a lot of representations of in, mm-hmm, the media.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we're out there doing it, we're kind of like, oh, am I supposed to look or act like the way I saw it? Am I supposed to,
mm-hmm,
dance like Dirty Dancing and have sex like this, you know, this porn clip that I saw?
Yeah, right. Yep, absolutely. And also, if you think about it, if you haven't watched porn, most sex you've witnessed through the media only is like these two people having penetrative sex and orgasming at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, who does that? Not many. We know that like 40% of people with vulvas do not orgasm from penetrative sex.
Yeah.
And like we know 80% of people orgasm from like external, like, you know, playing with the clitoris. So it's like, this isn't really representative of what's happening,
yeah.
But that's what we're emulating. And so, yeah, so there's bound to be a lot of places where somebody feels like they're not doing it right. Or,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it makes me think of, so are you familiar with Emily Nagoski's book, Come As You Are?
Yeah.
And like, I think that, you know, a book like that really gets into a lot of the studies and the science around that, but most people aren't going to read that. Like, you know, and it's like it's a wonderful book and it's a great resource, but like, there's a lot there. Whereas like, you know, I think you just showing this picture of these characters dancing and me like, I don't really know if I'm focused on my moves. Do I know how I'm looking? It's like, I think that just nails it. It just explains that feeling. And I think so many people will be able to relate to it.
Yeah, I'm glad. I think that's what I was hoping for. And I hope more people can realize that none of us are good at sex and that we all have to start somewhere.
Even when Clitty's adventures come to a close, there's even more that your book has to offer. And this I thought was really amazing. Like, there's this Clitty's lesson section at the end, which is like this whole resource guide that you have at the end of this wonderful story. And so there's these three parts. There's this rules of play, which is kind of a recap of what happened in the stories. There's the pick your pleasure, you know, kind of like a chart. And then there's Clitty's favorite dance moves. And as you can see, I've got that section bookmarked for myself. So I think these pages are worth revisiting over and over again, and I'd love to spend a little bit of time talking about each of them. So, like, first, with the rules of play, like, you know, these were really the lessons that we saw from Clitty's adventures, and you'd have, like, a little marker for each lesson. So tell us about, like, what you were thinking around that.
Yeah, I think that was kind of the sex ed part of it, right? I mean, all of it, the story, like, has all this feeling that comes with sexual experiences, but the end was kind of like, well, what do we do with that? And I think there's also so much sex ed that focuses on the physical experience of sex, like, you know, wearing protection, you know, what, you know, how do you prevent STDs, all of that kind of stuff. And I wanted this to be about the emotional experience of sex.
Yeah.
And that's what these lessons are about, is like, how do you practice consent in an emotionally safe way? How do you have communication in an emotionally safe way?
Yeah.
And then the only part that's more of the on the physical side is Clitty's dance moves. And honestly, those are just ideas. This isn't – and they're ideas that I gathered from asking a lot of people, what feels good to your body?
Let's talk a bit about the pick your pleasure part, because like like in the last few years, like, so just for the audience, the Pick Your Pleasure is essentially a worksheet that helps partners clearly communicate about the kinds of things that they're interested in exploring and, you know, kind of what level of different things that they can mark things on this page and talk about it with each other, which I think is fantastic. It's something I've been seeing in various communities, like a lot more of these kinds of forms come up. But I think what's nice about the version that you have is that it's much more simplified and approachable than a lot of the ones I've seen. Like, you know, some of them are pages and pages, like, you know, level of rating and all this kind of stuff. So, it feels like a great starter, you know, worksheet for people in this. And I'd love to hear more about what you chose to include and exclude and how you got to the form that you did.
Yeah. So I think all the lessons are a metaphor. And Pick Your Pleasures is about picking ice cream, because Clitty goes to this ice cream parlor, and, you know, is picking out what she likes and doesn't like. And I think, yeah, there is a lot of guides on, you know, do you like anal play? Do you like, you know, having someone go down on you, all that kind of stuff. And it's like, well, what if you just pick a body part that you want, you know, you'd like someone to touch, and then tell them like how you'd like them to engage that body part, and like what level of intensity and for how long, just like baseline. And I think that could be used at any point in time. And so I was hoping more of it being a skill set versus like this whole worksheet that later you'll probably forget, that you can be like, what kind of toppings do we want tonight? You know, and like, what do we want to put on our ice cream? What do we want to put in this sexual experience in this moment? And I think because people have such a hard time saying what they like and don't like, especially as they're kind of starting their sexual journey, or even years down the road.
Yeah.
They've been doing this thing for with a partner for a long time, and the partner's done this thing, and they've never told them they don't like it, and they're still doing it. But it's like, okay, could you be like, actually, let's take nipples off the table tonight? And like, I really like it when like you touch my back. That feels really good to me.
Yeah.
And I would like you to lightly graze my back with your fingernails. And I would like you to do that for 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of thinking, yeah, that way so that the person can continue to change it instead of it being this like stagnant thing that sits there. Because every sexual experience and every partner we have is going to create new opportunities for new ways to experience our body.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes me think of two things. So one, I can't help but think of where Clitty thinks to herself, like, maybe I put too many nuts on this. I just actually burst out laughing when I read that. I'm like, Clitty.
Yeah. And actually, Clitty didn't put the nuts on. Lang did.
Oh, there you go.
Right? But Clitty didn't tell Lang mm-hmm. that she didn't like nuts.
Yeah.
She let it go because she was like, oh, well, Lang knows better, you know? And so that's kind of that part of it of, you know, how do you start – you continually evolve your sexual narrative and your sexual likes and dislikes with the person you're with or with new people. And you don't have to just accept what somebody thinks is good or has practiced with someone before and was like, well, it really worked with that last person, so I'm going to do it again and again and again. Even though with this new person, like, they don't like for you to kiss their ears. That actually feels oversensitive. So, yeah, absolutely.
The other thing that it makes me think of is this book that came out recently called Magnificent Sex by Peggy Kleinplatz.
Mm-hmm.
This was a large-scale ethnographic study, essentially, where they just asked people about optimal sexual experience and you know, and what were the things that came up. And one of the things that was really interesting, which I think comes back exactly to the point that you're talking about, is she had one of the people who was talking about this and about not just variety for variety's sake, but the fact that you might want different things at different times. And they were kind of like, look, you know, you might love prime rib prepared in a certain way,
mm-hmm.
but if you had, and it might really hit the spot, but if you had prime rib every night for 40 years, you're probably not going to be happy about it.
Right, exactly. And we need new sexual experiences and ways to explore. And every body is different. And so we can't do the same things with everybody. We might try it and we might ask that person if they like it, but we want them to be able to say, no, I don't think I do like that. Or, you know, I do like prime rib, but tonight I don't want prime rib. Tonight exactly. I want some salmon, you know?
Exactly. And even the same body is changing over time.
Totally.
And like, you know, with levels of health or, you know, yeah. how we're feeling, what else is happening with us.
Absolutely.
Can affect what feels good at
yep.
a given time.
Yep, absolutely. So I see this as like a constantly evolving thing that people can use on, you know, day-to-day experience and become a metaphor that creates communication with people.
That's wonderful. So finally, and probably one of my favorite parts of the book is Clitty's favorite dance moves.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like you should blow that up to an 18x24 poster that people can just like put up in their bedrooms. I think it's just fantastic. But then it does give me pause to think about like Frangelina's lesson, where mm-hmm. Frangelina was too prescriptive about how things had to be, or even Ling, you know.
Yeah.
And I wonder about that balance of being too prescriptive can take away from pleasure. So what advice do you have for lovers who are trying to improve but don't want to be rote or mechanical and just like, you know, walk through all of Clitty's favorite dance moves and like, you know, how do they achieve balance with that?
Yeah, I think honestly the dance moves are to help people figure out what they like and don't like too. Mm. Like there's a hot and cold one. It's essentially people figuring out like, oh, that part's hot, you know,
mm.
and oh, colder. You're moving away from the pleasurable sensation.
Yeah.
Or like right or left side, like what side is more sensitive for you?
Yeah.
Or like, I'm going to try this thing. And then hopefully because the pick your pleasures is first, they can also say, you know, I want it for this long. I want to, you know, at this pressure, and they can see, they can use that language to use for this next part too of the dance move of like, okay, let's try it for a minute and see how I feel about it. No, not really doing a lot. I think that one's not going to work for me. Or let's try it a couple times and see how it works. Maybe today is like, I'm just feeling off or it's not the right time. But I don't think anything should be prescriptive about sex. I think that's why I didn't make this book like as like a lot of sex information books are yeah. very prescriptive, and they recreate like stereotypes and that like whole prime rib approach where you're like, you know, I have to do it this way every time because that's the only thing that this person likes. And it's like, well, no, like you got to keep evolving and trying different things. And so I'm hoping the dance moves just are ideas versus prescribed. Like try this thing. It could work for some people, not for every person. Try this thing for yourself. And the whole premise of the book is what feels good to you. Like, not to give away the ending, spoiler alert. But, you know, Clitty comes to the end of her journey. And what she finds out is that, you know, understanding her own likes and what feels good to her and listening to herself and, you know, like tapping to her own pleasure is actually how she writes the book finally. And so without that kind of knowledge, I hope nobody goes toward the dance moves. That's why I haven't pulled them out as like a separate thing. Because without that, and without trying them yourself first, then how can you really know what feels good to you? And do you trust yourself to communicate in a way in like with a partner, you know? And until you kind of know what feels good to you first. So that's like one of my basic things with even in counseling is like touch your own body first, see what feels good. And it may feel different with other people and know that. But just kind of explore and see, like have a relationship with your own body before you let someone else into that relationship. And I think that's a good principle to use as you go toward the dance moves as well.
Yeah. And I think even the way that you laid them out, I mean, that makes sense of not wanting to separate them for that reason. So they don't feel too prescriptive. But I think even in the format that you have them, because they're presented as a bunch of independent things, as opposed to here is the optimal sequence to, you know, to create pleasure or something, instead it's kind of like, here's some stuff, like, you know, like, go play.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very much in the spirit that you're saying that it's it feels exploratory as opposed to kind of like, here is what works for everyone, you know, ranked in order or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I love thinking of sexploration as, you know, that's a really fun pun for me too.
Such a good word. I've used that for most of my life too.
And yeah,
I'm amazed that we don't use it more.
Yeah.
So I just love the character of Clitty, and I really want to know what's going to happen next on her journey. Do you see more books or like figurines or stuffed toys? Like what's coming next?
Man, if I could only make all of that stuff happen. I've like had so many dreams about Clitty being a little stuffed animal that people can buy, or, you know, maybe a little knit thing, creature. But yeah, we'll see. I think a lot of that stuff takes a lot of like things in the background to do and complete. And I think I've had all these big dreams about it and been like, oh, okay, I got to be realistic that I don't know how to knit and I can't, I'm not going to knit a bunch of Clitties. So I think a lot of what we're doing with it is doing an Instagram where we put out sex education. So that's going to be kind of how Clitty continues, is through the Instagram and then through sex education series that me and another friend are putting together. I don't know if we're going to do another book just because it was a very costly endeavor to do one book. And you don't really make, I mean, it's not like I wanted to make money off the book, but I also, you know, losing money is also another thing. And unless it becomes like a, you know, a big hit, you lose a lot to like publishing and all of that stuff. But I think that I don't know, me and Danny have talked about making a hump film maybe. And just continuing to do sex education with the book as like kind of a centerpiece. And maybe someday when I have maybe a little bit more time and more settled in my own business too, I think that maybe I would consider creating another book. We wanted to make it a series, but I think I don't want to put pressure on myself to do that at this point, because it was a really fun process, but just long. And so I think I need some time before I do anything else.
Yeah, that's fair. As a fellow author, I mean, one thing that I'm always curious about and thinking about for myself too is like, how do you publicize and spread the word about your book to others? I'm just curious, what things have you done? What's worked for you?
Yeah, I think mostly just through word of mouth, through the Instagram, and through doing like fun events, you know, whether it's the Seattle Erotic Art Festival or talking about it in other podcasts, or even like, I'm going to be, because of the podcast I did recently, I think they're submitting part of that because there's also a video portion of it, for a hump film. So, and then spreading it within the sex therapy community and things like that. So just kind of getting it out through word of mouth and through the community that I do have. And we have big dreams of doing other things as well. But I think that's been the thing that's most sustainable. Cause it, you know, it's kind of the side hustle thing that we get to do. And I'd love to do it all the time, but I also have to make money and work and things like that. So
yeah,
that's what's working for right now. So
that makes sense. So the last question I like to ask of all my guests, and you've mentioned a number of queer resources already, which is wonderful, and we'll have all those links in the episode. But are there any particular like queer resources, films, books, or Instagram accounts that something in particular you'd love to spread the word about that you feel like more people should be seeing or listening to?
Yeah. So on my website is, you can find it, Colorful Therapy is my business name. And it's just colorfultherapy.com. Usually I have to put in Seattle, Colorful Therapy Seattle, and Google and you'll find it. There's a whole sex ed section, and in there I have, the bottom is a whole list of Instagrammers that is everything from queer and trans information to sex ed information to body explorative information. Mm-hmm. And a lot of really amazing influencers doing work around that. One of my favorite ones is Shrimp Teeth. They do a lot of work around relationships and poly stuff and sex ed. Another really cool film that's came out within, I think, the last like 2 years, is called The Dilemma of Desire by Maria Vinizzo. And that's a really cool look at, the ways that the clitoris has been left out of like essentially sex, medical information, yeah, education, mm-hmm, all of that kind of stuff. And the idea that, you know, female desire is like not centered in any of those conversations.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important and really awesome. Sophia Wallace is also another really awesome artist who's doing a lot of work around promoting essentially misinformation about sex ed and clitorises and all of that stuff. So those are some ones I would recommend for sure. But I think there's so many that I couldn't go through them all. So I think they're on my website. So if people want to follow people, and I always recommend, that's like one of the main things I do with my clients, is follow good people. Mm. Do not follow body negative people. Don't follow people who are like negative towards sex or relationships. Follow people who are expansive. Follow people who give accurate information, because that's how you get it. And then you're surrounded by it. So you start to see that stuff over and over again, and it affects you. So if you're following things that are hurtful and putting out these negative messages, those are becoming a part of you too. So be conscious of your media usage.
That's wonderful. And we'll have all of those resources linked with this episode, of course. So thank you so much, Rihanna, for joining us today on Queer Kahani. I'm so glad that you could come and speak with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great to be here. And I love what you're creating through this. It's awesome to have these kind of conversations, and thanks for being such a big supporter of Clitty as well.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to. So for the folks at home, you can pick up Rihanna's book at Papichu Press, papichupress.com, and you can follow Clitty's antics on her Instagram at Clitoris Chronicles. Thanks so much for joining us today, and you can find all the links we discussed today as well as other episodes on queerkahani.com. See you all next time.